The following is the 11th part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality. Due to some technical difficulties, the audio quality on this recording may sound different than on previous recordings.
We're continuing in our series on the temporal versus the eternal, the idea of what we call paradigm spirituality, embracing a different paradigm in this world than that which is normally visible, that which we can see or touch or taste or handle. We are now called to pursue that which is unseen above that which is seen, which takes a tremendous amount of risk in doing so. We've talked last week about the contrast between the temporal and the eternal in terms of pleasure for the temporal, recognition, popularity of people, wealth and status and power. And we observe that this is what the world will teach us to pursue every time. It will not teach us to pursue knowing God instead of pleasure, approval of God over recognition, servanthood over popularity, integrity and character above wealth and status, and humility above power. It just will not do that. But my point is simply this, that if you look at what they add up to, at the end of the day, Scripture is correct. The pursuit of these things, and we have the consistent testimony over the centuries of people who have pursued these things, who at the end of the road have said what? It's not what it was cracked up to be. Every time they pursue this, at the end of the journey, they know that led to emptiness and to delusion and to foolishness. It doesn't require any extra empirical evidence to determine this, because this is trying to live as if life is all about me. On the eternal side, we're trying to live as if life is all about God. And it's a paradigm movement. So that if we truly embrace the truth of Scripture, by pursuing these things that God treasures and God declares to be important, He tells us that the product of that pursuit will eventually lead to fulfillment, reality, and wisdom, as opposed to emptiness, delusion, and foolishness. Fulfillment, as I defined last week, is really the fruit of the Spirit, is one way of defining it. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Reality is that which will endure. The one who does the will of God abides forever. The world's passing away, but the one who does the will of God abides forever. And I defined wisdom as living in such a way that it conforms to real reality, to truth. And it's that which gives us skill in the art of life. Wisdom always relates to the idea of skill. It's the skill in living life with each area under the dominion and authority of God. One of the things we talked about last week, though, at the end was, well, how do we apply this day to day in our business relationships? And I want to just say another quick word about that. We talked a little bit about what that might mean about practicing His presence, but there are a couple of other issues that surface to me that are important. And one of those issues is truth and trust. I want you to think about that for a moment. What we have is a God who has claimed to give us truth. He says, Jesus says, sanctify them in your word is truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. That you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Truth, then, is to be greatly treasured, and truth will not be obtained by mere human acquisition. Truth, instead, is something revealed to us by a God who gives us a third way of knowing besides merely empirical knowledge and rational knowledge. Important as these two are, empirical and rational knowledge will not carry us to the fundamental answers to the questions of life, namely, where do we come from? Who are we? Why are we here? Where are we going? Those things, unaided human reasoning, can never satisfy the human quest. It'll require a third way of knowing, namely revelation, a revelation of God's truth. And the Word of God, then, is this timeless and eternal truth, because God's truth doesn't change, because He Himself does not change, because He is immutable, which means simply that He doesn't change. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, yes, and forever. Because He Himself never changes, because His character never changes, then whatever He reveals to us, we can be assured will be the truth, in spite of the fact that in this shadow world, in these shadow lands, in these dark lands, it'll often seem that what God says may not really be true. We'll wonder about the things that He affirms. Because we're always going to be tempted to question those truths by embracing the eternal and the temporal. And again, I'm going to suggest that the world and all its machinations will always cause us to turn toward the temporal and reinforce that mindset. So it requires some real risk to embrace God's values over the values of this world. And that's where trust comes in. It's not just a question of truth, it's also a question of trust. You've got to decide what you're putting your trust into, because you will put your trust into something. Most men I know put their trust in themselves. That's essentially what it is. They're going to let themselves down in the end. That the idea of thinking that you yourself are the supreme object and worthy object of trust is a tremendous blunder, as we well know. We've let ourselves down in timeless ways. We can't really say and do and think the things we really want to say, do, and think. We find ourselves at loggerheads here. And I'm simply saying that you will trust someone or something. And you will serve someone or something. Better to serve the Lord rather than to serve men. Better to serve the one who's the creator rather than to serve the creation. And so if we understand this idea, you will need to trust. And that's why I like that word trust even more in some ways than believe, because believe, really pistuo, the Greek word, is better thought of as trust rather than merely intellectual assent. When we use the word believe, I believe about that, there can be different meanings of that. I can believe, for example, in the sense of the Latin word notitia, where I give notice to something and I see it's there. I can believe in the sense of assentia, where I not only see it but also give affirmation to it. Or I can believe in the sense of fiducia, which means I not only see it and assent to it, but I also embrace it. You see the idea? And that is really the idea of biblical trust. It is one thing to believe intellectually about who Christ is. I did that when I was 13 years old. I came to an intellectual belief that Jesus was who he claimed to be. Thought that was enough. And for another 8 years, I went on in the illusion that I really knew what Christianity was about. Deep in my heart, though, I knew better. Deep in my heart, I knew there was something awry, and I didn't want to deal with that directly, because I felt that having made this decision to believe in Christ, or believe Christ, that would be enough. It was only when I was 21 that I made the decision. Really a decision virtually made for me. God revealed or manifested himself in powerful ways and really caused me to realize I was sitting on a fence. I was, on the one hand, really not trying to accept him or reject him as a Lord, and I was just but I didn't want to abandon him, so I was trying to avoid a decision as to where I'm going to really give my life. I came to the point where I went from intellectual assent to personal reception. And that's what's made all the difference. In other words, it's trusting in a person, not believing in a proposition. That's really what makes the difference. Christianity is a trust in a person, not belief in a proposition. Now, again, I'm not down on proposition. You understand, I'm actually big on propositional truth. God's word is filled with propositions. But if it's where you stop, it's not enough. That you've got to move beyond propositions to a person about whom the propositions really point and describe. The fact is that we are called to pursue a person behind the propositions and trust in that person. Well, so I want to suggest then that as we go back to the temporal dimension, then do we bag it? Do we chuck it away and throw it off? No, I'm going to suggest that the temporal has a purpose. And I want to suggest here that we basically pursue excellence in the temporal, but that you hope in the eternal. So that when you pursue excellence in the temporal, you also, though, realize that your hope, though, is still in the eternal, so that actually the two inform one another, because an eternal hope will cause you to seek a greater life than what you would have otherwise pursued. So you're not abandoning the quest for worldly success, but not as the Bible describes it. Here's what I want to say. The difference is this. In the temporal, you can hope in things. hoping for things rather in the eternal. That's where you hope in. You understand the difference? You hope in the eternal. You might hope for some things in the temporal. We might hope for a better job. We might hope for a better situation in our life. We can hope for things, and there's nothing wrong with hoping for things as long as you don't hope in them. There's only one you're supposed to hope in, and that's Christ. So you put your hope in Him, and you hold your temporal hopes with a loose enough grip so that they are not realized, they don't destroy you because you weren't hoping in them. Is that distinction clear to you? That idea is very important. I'm wanting to say here, you don't just shuck the earth and being relevant in this world. My view here is that actually an eternal perspective will inform the temporal engagements of our lives and cause us to be, if anything, to be actually more effective in this world. Any questions on that? Because that to me is very, very critical, the combination of the two. Some of you know I've done some of the great books, and I've actually got to get back into it now. I've taught through 14 out of 70 books that I want to teach, so I got to get cracking here. One of those 14 books, though, was Divina Commedia, the Divine Comedy of Dante. I plan to teach it again because this time I've got to teach that with some visual images. You can't teach it without it because you have to represent the various areas where he went and so forth, and it's just almost impossible to teach without. So I'm planning to do that in the future. But I want to suggest that literature provides a very interesting way of giving us ordered information about behavior and models of purpose and of lives that have been lived successfully or patterned after meaningful goals. And the whole issue in literature is often goals and either the frustration of those goals or the quest for the attainment of those goals against sometimes insurmountable odds. And so there's a lot of drama that goes along with literature. I know of no better work to describe the midlife crisis than the Divine Comedy. A lot of people go through a midlife crisis, which means that they realize they've accomplished about as much as they're probably going to accomplish or achieved about as much. Now where do I go from here? Especially given the fact that people are living longer than they used to live, that they have more options than they used to have, and more wealth than they used to have. They have more freedoms, so that it gives us pause. I don't think really that a laborer or a farmer in 14th century England really had a midlife crisis. You know, I just don't think that was an issue with them. Because what they've done is what they're going to do.
And I buy a fast donkey? Do I go
buy a fast donkey? I got to get a hot donkey here? What is this? Maybe a better cart? You know, it just doesn't work. You know, and the fact is that, you know, your grandfather and your grandfather's father, they all were doing this, and that's what you're going to do, and that's what your kids are going to do, because that was the way it was. It wasn't a fluid economy. They were trying to survive. Feudalism isn't the time you want to be living in. Frankly, 14th century England is not, that century in Europe is a terrible century. We're living in a great time. We've got options the world never even dreamed of before. But given these three things of greater longevity, of greater actual possessions, and third, greater opportunity, that really forces us to raise some questions. Because once we have made our mark in this world, then we have to say, is that all there is? Or so what? Or where do I go from here? Having authenticated myself, I discovered that I really didn't authenticate myself, because there's always the quest, the longing for more. You all know what I'm talking about. And often everyone has this longing, but we generally don't come into contact with that longing until somewhere in the middle of the journey of this life. It's often in a window where we discover that that frustration and that struggle. As one friend puts it here, as we look at our lives and we seeing our capacity diminish, and we see responsibilities in many ways increasing, there's a frustration point when we see that our energies begin to diminish, our amount of time and so forth. And usually there's a little window here, somewhere in the middle of this process here, usually between 38 and 45. When guys come into an what happens here? you can already look ahead and predict it, can't you? You can predict it,
No. But
you do not experience it. It's only in this window or around this window, some before, some after, naturally, but on average, people really begin to wrestle existentially with this issue, usually around that time of their lives. Some people may wrestle with it earlier and wonder in their earlier 30s. Some might be able to somehow put it off until their 50s, but somewhere along the line, you're going to run into this crisis. Or is it a process? Whether it's a crisis or a process depends on your approach to life. If you see it as a crisis, you're trying to seek an identity in the temporal, and you're discovering that your resources, your capacities are diminishing, and you have not achieved all that you hoped that you would achieve. We all have fond aspirations. Things we hoped for don't always come about. Whether that relates to our families, our children, our job, our health, our energy, any number of things, rarely does a person go through life and all the things they hope for come to pass. And even if you do achieve enormous amounts, it's still not enough because God has made us for Himself. And our hearts are restless until they find the rest in Him. When we go through this window, we discover then an experiential struggle with our mortality. We knew we were mortal, but we really didn't know we were mortal. You know what I mean by that? In other words, you knew it, but you didn't know it. You were able somehow to put that at arm's length and say that's something that happens to other people. It's only when you start to discover this. I had a friend of mine who said, I think when he hit 60, he says, you know, we all know that, you know, that as you go up to the hill of life, you know, and you're over the hill, and he says, looking off in the distance, you see the grave. He says, we already knew it was there, but now that I'm up here, I can see the damn thing. So that's what it's about.
Only with glasses, though.
only with glasses. Yeah, only with glasses. I claim that this can be either a crisis of identity, or it can be a process. And my belief is that God has actually wired us in such a way that the midlife process can be redemptive by causing us to wean our hopes in this world and to transfer them more and more to God's promises. So what will happen then is, as time goes by, is as He diminishes, in the game of musical chairs, He'll take significant chairs out of your life. And then you have to go around and around, and then there's another chair. And it comes down to the question of whether it's just going to be house and spouse, or whether there's going to be something more fundamental than that. The idea of, yes, it's good to have relationships, and it's nice to have a family, but what's life about in the end? And so we have to ask these tough, tough questions. My belief is that if we go through this process and fix our eyes on Christ and our hope, our eternal hope in Him, it can actually cause us to live with greater maturity. On the first end of the process, we're looking for answers. On the second half, we're living with ambiguity, knowing we don't have all the answers, but we can trust the One who does. In the first half, we're always trying to control. In the second half, we realize we never were in control, you see. In the first half, you're trying to acquire. Now, in the second half, you realize that everything is God's and that you owned nothing at all. And you could go on and on with the contrasts between the two. And so I'm saying that actually we need to go through a process, not a crisis. It's a process if, in fact, it animates a living hope. As I've described before, our hope is a living, not a dead hope. Many people put their hope in something that dies. But we've been called born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is a hope that will not deteriorate. We've been called to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, will not fade away, and is reserved in heaven for you. That is your hope. So as we look at this then, we see the struggle we have. Going back to Dante, listen to the very, very opening words of the Divine Comedy. In the middle of the journey of our life, wrote Dante in the first line of his enormously long and rich poem, I found myself inside a dark forest, for the right way I had completely lost. Is that not a good description? In the middle of the journey of our life. Now, if you study the Divine Comedy, it happened when he was 35 years old. And with the wisdom of Psalm 90, what does it say as to our lifespan? As to the days of the years of our life, it's 80 years, or if due to strength, 80. So he was assuming a 70-year lifespan. At the age of 30, then, he was at the middle of the journey of our life. And he found himself, as he says, in the middle of a dark wood. He found himself in a dark forest, for the right way I had completely lost. A lot of people discover that they're in a dark forest somewhere in the middle of their journey of their life. They find themselves completely lost. They're looking for a way out. What's worse, you discover some other problems that he describes. And again, this is a gripping and still relevant account of the difficulties to be encountered in middle age. First of all, in wandering the dark forest, he realizes that there are three fierce beasts that are stalking him. And the first of those beasts is a lion. He sees also that he's being stalked by a lynx, and third by a she-wolf. Now, these represent, among other things, ambition, lust, and greed. The lion would represent ambition, the lynx, lust, the she-wolf, greed. Reminds me a little bit of Tom Wolfe's novels. You may remember Bonfire of the Vanities, 1988, middle-aged New York bond trader. And what you have there is the same three things: power, sex, and money. Or you could, as I said before, ambition, lust, and greed. The lion, the lynx, and the she-wolf. We found ourselves pursued by those things. Man in Full is another example of a Tom Wolfe novel that illustrates a man who is again consumed by those kinds of things, trying to authenticate his existence in a temporal world. So to avoid being destroyed by them, then, Dante tries to escape by climbing a hill, but the beasts keep drawing ever nearer and nearer. And he realizes that unaided by divine power, he will be ultimately devoured by them. So then he cries out for divine help. Isn't it true in your life that sometimes things have to come to the end of their road before you cry out for divine help? It's, I find, sad, isn't it? I wonder what God thinks about it. He's like the God of the last refuge. Has it come to this? We have to pray about it? Sort of a mindset there. Frankly, again, I don't know how he puts up with this, but he well knows that no one comes to him out of pure motives. And he well knows that the gift of severe mercies, taking our toys and trinkets away, may well be the only thing that will cause us to realize that we're being pursued so hard that the only by turning to divine resources do we have a way out of this dark wood. That's really the idea. Now what happens is his prayer is answered, and he sees a vision of the ghost of the Latin poet Virgil. Why Virgil? Because Dante regarded Virgil, who died over 1,000 years before he lived. And by the way, the Divine Comedy is taking place about, I think, the year 1301, right in there. Virgil was his mentor as a poet and as an artist. And so he becomes a guide. But he realizes in this that Virgil can only carry him so far. He's still a pagan. But he has worldly wisdom and insight, so Virgil can carry him, and what he discovers that Virgil's going to do is carry him only so far. But what happens is, the good news is that there is a way out of the dark forest. That's the good news. The bad news is that the way leads through hell, you see. And so as they descend through hell, and they slowly wend their way, witnessing as they go the sufferings of those people who had abandoned and given their lives in exchange for goals that let them down in the end, for a life script that was really totally improper because they had been devoured by the she-wolf or the lion or the lynx. He sees those various spheres of hell, and as he goes further down, it's interesting that the sins of the flesh are in the higher levels, but the sins of the spirit are in the lower levels, and the worst ones are pride and also the treachery of violating a trust and a relationship. This is why Judas is way down there. Then Satan is in the very middle of the earth. It's a very bizarre scenario because, again, the way down is up. So that if you were to look at this process here, and if you look at the earth here, he goes down to the center of the earth, and Satan is at the center of this, oddly enough or interestingly enough, not in fire, but totally encapsulated by ice. He's not able to really move. But then they continue to go, wend their way through, because there is a path that leads to the other side of the earth. And when they emerge from that path, there are it's a seven-story mountain that they're now climbing up. And as they climb up that mountain, that's Mount Purgatory. You see the idea there? And what happens, regardless of your view of purgatory, is this. It's a purgation. And I believe in a purgation that's necessary. We must all appear before the divine judgment seat of Christ and give an account for ourselves. And each man's work will be tested, and it will be as if, as though through fire, whatever remains will receive a reward, but the wood, hay, and stubble will be burned off, but the gold, silver, and precious things will remain. So there is this image of purgation. And what it is, it's a purgation of Dante's very sins until it goes through this. And so there's the word peccate, P, on his forehead that's eventually going to be removed. Peccate means sin. And then from there, he is able to rise then into the sphere of heaven itself in paradise. Interesting, as so often the case, Paradiso is in my opinion, the weakest part of the Divine Comedy. Why is that? There's a reason.
What part was that?
The paradise. And then you have Dante's Inferno is the thing everyone likes. Very few people like Purgatory. I mean, not as many people like Purgatorio, but Paradiso. What's that?
Because it's the trip.
It's the trip.
Not the destination.
Oh, no, because of the trip and not the destination. There's a thought there, isn't there? And I think you're right in part, because you see, most people's idea of heaven is that it's a destination and therefore that it is inert, that we don't do anything, which I think is very sub-biblical. So we treasure the journey over the end, but actually the end of the journey is the beginning of a new and more exciting journey than we could have ever imagined on earth. My view here is that it's so indescribable, so beyond the realm of human imagination, that the poet doesn't have the resources, artistic resources, to capture it. But he captures Inferno very well. Because all he has to do is look inside himself. As C.S. Lewis said, you know, it was actually easy for me to write the Screwtape Letters. All I had to do was examine my own motives, my own heart. He says that was really easy to do. He could identify as a poet what that pain looks like and also the process of purgation. But what's unimaginable is the next life. Again, as we said, eye has not seen, neither ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for those who love him. But he says, friends, you need to trust me. It's going to be more than worth your while. And anything that you think you're going to lose, it'll be more than made up for you in heaven. I know I must bore you by giving you the same illustrations again and again, but Lewis's illustration of the boy hearing about sex for the first time, he's about 9-10 years old, is my favorite for this about heaven. Some of you heard it, some of you hear it again. After all, repetition is the mother of learning. That's my excuse. There's a boy who asks about this thing called sex that he's been hearing about, and he's a young boy, maybe 9 or 10, and his dad starts telling him about this, and the more he hears about it, the more bizarre and unappealing it sounds to him. And then he asks his father, well, do they eat chocolates when they do it? Because you see, the pleasure of chocolates, the boy understands. But this other pleasure is totally foreign to him. And he says, Johnny, no, actually the lovers in their bliss have something better to think about than chocolate. What does Johnny go away thinking? He defines sex as the absence of chocolate. You catch that? And that's where I'm going here. If you're not careful, you'll define heaven as the absence of earthly endeavor and creative expression. But I want to suggest actually that heaven, it turns out, as I like to put it, one of the qualities of heaven is endless creative activity without frustration to the glory of God. This time, though, your action will not be frustrated, and you'll have the energy to accomplish it, and you'll have all the time you need. Time will no longer be your enemy, taking your life away. Rather, it'll be an ocean in which you swim. It'll be a medium of expression, and it'll never be your enemy again. Your experience of time will be radically different than your experience of time. Your experience of space, and again, that too will be different. And I promise you, you don't have the imagination to really conceive of it. But as we go through this process then, I think we all with Dante realize that we're being pursued by various beasts. As we try to go up and we realize we cannot make our way out of this forest and we cannot arrive at the top of the hill on our own. You've got to seek divine aid. Virgil, by the way, only carries him through purgatory, and then because he was a pagan, it's Beatrice who has to bring him through heaven, who was this image that he had, almost like an archetype of the image of God when he saw this young woman, and he realized that there was this incredible longing that she created in him. Now you had a question.
Is Christ and the grace of Christ a part of the scenario in Dante's Inferno?
Yes, it is. The grace of, although keep in mind now, the grace, it's the grace is seen as the removal of his sins rather than his own working them off. In the case of purgatory here, he's not working them off, but rather he is becoming. They're being revealed to him. And he's responding to them. It's a sanctification process. And frankly, that's what life is about, really. Once you come into the kingdom of God, once you come into a relationship, the sanctification process begins, and really, even now, purgation starts taking place.
But I mean, I have not read Dante's Inferno. Is there in the text an actual naming of Christ, his crucifixion?
Oh, yeah. It centers around the person of Christ.
Okay.
Everything centers. In fact, at the very center, there are nine heavens. I don't know where we get the seventh heaven from. But there are... that's only three heavens.
Seven?
No, you're
right.
Yeah, there's only three heavens in the scriptures. But regardless,
it was a Janet Gaynor film.
I gotcha.
And in front of it, Christ making the way across the trenches.
Christ makes the way across the trenches. And Christ, by the way, all what we have here as he goes into heaven, he sees various spheres, like crystalline spheres. And each one is higher than the other. And finally, at the very center of all things is the divine Trinity. And that's the love that moves the sun and the stars. So that's how he ends the poem. Is the love that moves the sun and the stars. It's a great image there, but it's the love of Christ. And he sees the Trinity, but he cannot see it. But it's like three circles of light, but they're not each other, but they're one, which is his way of describing that, a vision beyond description. Reminds me of Gary Larson's cartoon where he has this one guy and he's on a cloud and he's in heaven. He's got his cloud and he's watching his TV. I always have his guys watching TV. Even amoebas watch TV with Gary Larson. But he's floating around here. And then there's another cloud above him, and all you can do is see the little musical symbols, you know, notes and so forth, and excitement going on up there. And what you've got here, because obviously that guy's on a better cloud, and so his caption is, "Life on Cloud 8." Only he could come up with such a crazy notion. I fear I'm close to being out of time. Just a thought. I want to tell you where I'm heading next week. Next week I want to talk about our presuppositions. I'm going to be arguing that your way of viewing the world will shape your perspective on life. Because after all, we're talking, aren't we, about an eternal versus a temporal perspective. What you embrace as your worldview will shape your perspective on life. Then secondly, your perspective will shape your priorities. What perspective you have will then, by its own nature, shape your priorities. And as your priorities are being shaped, then so it moves, and your priorities shape your practice. So I want to move us down to from the worldview issue to your perspective, and then to your priorities, and then finally into your practice. That's where we're heading.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.